Session number 4654, reel number 2.
Army Film Unit cameraman David McDonald, reel 2. You also filmed the Lofoten raid. Indeed, you filmed it in colour.
It was photographed in colour only by myself. The other two officers on that were Tennyson Daincourt and Harry Rignold, who were both captains. I was the only one carrying a colour camera, and that was with 16mm. It was very spectacular, and the spectacular and I suppose one would call a slightly dangerous operation. There were two ships that went over, all with commando troops.
What facilities were you given as cameraman?
Nothing extra at all. Nothing extra.
Were you all on the same ship?
We were all on the same ship.
And Commander Kimmins was there as well?
Commander Kimmins was there. The only special thing that we got, because we were carrying a lot of rather valuable equipment, was that we three, Tennyson Daincourt, Rignold and myself, were given a cabin to ourselves, as opposed to all the other troops who were about 7 or 8 to a cabin, or down in below decks, 40 or 50 men at a time, as it were.
Who had supplied you with colour film? What sort of colour film was it?
Technicolour. Technicolour supplied me with the film. And incidentally, they supplied me with a 16mm camera. It was done by Technicolour.
Which they then retrieved after the
event. They did the developing of the colour film, which I brought back.
You think that this colour film was blown up into 35mm,
yes.
Black and white?
Black and white,
for
yes.
Inclusion in the M of I?
Yes, it was. Definitely.
But you've never seen the colour film itself since? Or
no,
have any idea where it might be?
No idea where it might be now.
When Hess arrived in England, you asked to photograph him, did you not?
I asked to photograph him, and it was blankly refused. They wouldn't have any part of it, War Office. They wouldn't allow me near Hess.
Do you know why this was?
Well, he was a highly political prisoner. And it went as high, it went right up to, I think, the Prime Minister for permission to photograph him, but it was refused. I've never quite discovered what their grounds were, but that's the way it was.
The government apparently had little idea of the value of film propaganda.
Practically none, really. The idea of propaganda at that time was rather the things like don't talk, the enemy might be listening, and that type of thing.
Very negative.
Very negative.
Did this make your job a difficult one?
Well, frustrating is the word, I think.
Because government attitudes presumably permeated the army.
That's right, exactly that.
Were there other occasions apart from the Hess incident when you were refused facilities for filming?
Not that I can remember offhand, no. No. We were never, let me put it this way, we were never enthusiastically welcomed. I mean, commanding officers of a unit were rather said I suppose they're in uniform, these people, and they've got a job to do, so reluctantly they were given and allowed things to be photographed. one little thing I remember was photographing a tank exercise, fording a river down at just outside Salisbury. And I think four tanks took off and only one landed on the other side. The rest were being, you know, pulled out the river by other tanks. A man who was in charge, the one who did do the actual leap right across the river, was a man called, again, I knew very well in the desert, a man called Jimmy Dance.
Jimmy?
Dance, D-A-N-C-E. And he was a captain in the something yeomanry or whatever it was.
To return to the desert, what did you see your function as when you went out to the Middle East in late 41? To make a documentary about the army, to build up a unit, to make cameramen acceptable to the army?
I think that could be, yes, that is correct. When I first went out there, I mean, I had no idea that we were going to make a film such as Desert Victory became. And that was, came quite by accident. And how it became an accident was the fact that I was coming back from Tobruk, back to Cairo. And on the side of the road was General Alexander, plus the Secretary of State for War, I think it was.
Grigg?
No, I'm sorry, he wasn't the Secretary of State for War. He's very high up in the government. Anyway, I stopped my jeep and asked the General Alexander if one of my cameramen with me could take a couple of shots for him for propaganda purposes. They were having lunch, as I said, on the side of the road. And I was given permission by Alexander, of course, he said, and I carried on. Then he wanted to know exactly what the Army Film Unit were doing. So I told him that we had photographed with, you know, some 30 or 40 cameramen, and we'd got somewhere in the region of about, let's say, 800,000 feet of film. Alexander said, well, what's eventually going to happen to it? And I said, well, one day, sir, I hope we're going to turn it into a film of the actual desert campaign. 3 days later, I was on my way back to England on the orders of General Alexander to make the film Desert Victory.
He was favorably inclined towards film, presumably.
Very much so.
Was this the case with the other generals that you met?
No, far from it. The man's name I was trying to think of just now with Alexander when they were picnicking on the side of the road was Oliver. What was his name?
Lees.
Oliver Lees, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that was.
Was Montgomery hostile to cameramen before Al Alamein?
Well, he hardly recognized us. Let's put it that way. He didn't. He wasn't keen on it. He wasn't keen on cinematography in any shape or form. He did condescend to allow us to photograph at his headquarters on the coast just south of Mersa Matru or something like that, somewhere like that. And we photographed him greeting von Thoma, the German general who had just been captured. And we caught that on cinema. But until Desert Victory came, he hardly knew we existed. Wasn't a bit keen on it.
Had you yourself seen the German military propaganda films, Victory in the West, Baptism of Fire?
No. No. Not until much, much later. The when we did...
Because you might have shown those films to the British generals to demonstrate what could be...
What we did get at Merzmetru, we found some 30,000 feet of German film, which of course helped enormously, which went into the compilation of Desert Victory, so that you saw what the Germans were doing and retreating, advancing and retreating, and of course ourselves advancing the whole time on Desert Victory.
Did you cooperate at all with the Commonwealth film unit? The Indian, Australian, South African?
Yes. They used our laboratories, for example, in Cairo. But the Australians were always... they were always willing, and I don't remember any Canadians, really. The Australians were very good. Indian, I don't think they had a film unit at that time. Or would they have? Would you know that?
They had an officer in Indian PR, Captain Ingram.
That's correct. I remember him. I do remember him. I think he was the only one, though.
I think so, at this stage.
I think he was.
1942.
Yep, sure he was.
After the making of Desert Victory, the Indians did, however, object to the fact that they were not included in the film. Was this an oversight, or could it have been prevented?
Well, truthfully, I don't remember that.
Desert Victory was the Army Film Unit's first big success with the public.
Yes, I'd say that's correct. Definitely. We had made two or three other films which were shown to the public, but not on a great scale, not on any big scale like Desert Victory was.
These were small films about different aspects of army life.
Just that. For example, there was one film we made in Cairo with General Alexander called Tough Tactics, which was a 10-minute film, and it was... I'm sorry, I'm wrong on that. It was a 30-minute film, and showed the training that troops had to go through in the desert in order to, you know, in order to toughen them up. Tough Tactics.
Did you have any part in the selection of subjects for AFU Productions?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. I mean, I could, you know, as commanding officer, I had to tell my troops exactly where to go and what I wanted shot.
I'm talking specifically about the choice of films to be made rather than mere record footage.
No, nobody dictated to me on that at all. That was entirely my decision, whether it was in the desert or whether it was later in Burma or elsewhere.
Desert Victory contains a fair amount of material which appears to have been staged. Did you have any policy on your cameraman filming staged or reconstructed events?
The only bit in Desert Victory which was staged were the night shots on the barrage, not the barrage itself, because that was shot by my own cameramen in the desert. But there was about 200 feet only which was restaged. For example, if you remember the picture at all, there was a scene with the Argyll Sutherland Highlanders advancing across the no man's land of the Western Desert. That was staged. As I say, it was about 200 feet.
Did you give your cameraman special instructions that they should go as far forward to the fighting as possible and never reconstruct material?
Oh, yes.
Behind the lines?
Yes, of course. Very much so.
Did you see the work of the Army Film Unit, therefore, in slightly different terms to the work of the newsreel cameraman, who, for example, Terry Ashwood, who you mentioned earlier, was a notorious stager of events?
Yes, that is true, I would say.
Did you think that the newsreels perhaps could get away with staging, but the Army Film Unit should not?
I would say that's correct, yes. I mean, the Army Film Unit were a competent bunch of men. They were not civilians, they were soldiers.
Did you think that there was a distinction between shooting film for record purposes, which is a phrase which occurs quite early on in the dope sheets, and filming for publicity purposes? In other words, making sure that the film would be shown in the newsreels, and therefore not filming the gory side of war, not filming defeats, not filming the retreat from Greece through Crete. Did you have any thoughts on this subject?
Really, truthfully, I can't say I didn't at the time. No, not really.
After the premiere of Desert Victory in London in March 1943, you then took the film to the United States.
Yes.
As an ambassador, almost.
Well, we showed the film at the Odeon Theatre in Leicester Square, and it went down in a very big way. My commanding general at that time was Lord Burnham, since deceased, and a man who was head of, well, he was a sort of personnel, very high-ranking personnel officer at the Ministry of Information. His name was Sidney Bernstein, now Lord Bernstein. And through his offices, he went to the Secretary of State for War and said, this film must be taken over by MacDonald to America on a lecture tour. So I was given top priority and was put on a plane taking American pilots back to America to ferry more planes back to this country for the war effort. And I was landed in Boston, I think it was, and was flown immediately down to Washington. And that was on a Friday night. On the Sunday night, I was summoned to the British Embassy. On the Saturday, I was summoned to the British Embassy and told that I was to show the film and lecture to Franklin D. Roosevelt the following evening, Sunday, which went down in a very big way. And after that, of course, I toured every big city in America.
Can you remember Roosevelt's comments about the film? Was he entirely favorable?
Oh, he was entirely favorable. 100%. Because it was he that said this must be shown throughout the whole length and breadth of the United States. Which it was. And one of the...
You yourself accompanied the film...
Everywhere.
Wearing uniform.
Wearing uniform. It was shown to the press club in Washington with a crowd of about 300 pressmen. And as a consequence, of course, it got one terrific press throughout the whole of the USA. It appeared, you know, in particularly in Hollywood, for example. I got umpteen cables, one from Cecil B. DeMille, who I'd worked with as an assistant, as I've told you, and he sent me a cable saying, what's it feel like to be famous? Signed Cecil B. DeMille, that's all.
And then the film won an Oscar for the best documentary of 1943.
That's right.
Which you still have in this room?
No, it's out in the hall, I think.
You then returned to the Middle East for the invasion of Italy.
For the invasion of Sicily. The invasion of Sicily, and then we were in Sicily only 3 weeks, all told, I think. And then we took off, and from Sicily, I, with a man you mentioned just now, Terry Ashwood, and myself, plus three or four others, and we landed at
Salerno.
Landed at Salerno, and that's where Harry Rignall was killed.
Was he in the same jeep as yourself?
No. We were on different landing ships. Terry Ashwood and I were on one ship, Harry Rignold and one of his sergeants on one of my sergeants on another one. He was little Harry Rignall. He was only a tiny little fellow, but he had tremendous guts. And the jeep he was driving off his landing craft received a direct hit, and he was immediately put back on board the landing craft and to go back to Tripoli, but he died halfway across because he'd lost both legs. He's buried in Tripoli.
Was he your best cameraman, or would you not say that you had one superlative cameraman?
On the Italian campaign, I would say Harry Rignold was the most experienced cameraman in desert warfare, or in warfare of any description.
Did you have anything to do with the training of cameramen?
Much later. That was after I came back from Juan. I was down at the training depot at Pinewood, where we did train cameramen.
So after Salerno, you got malaria and returned to the UK.
After Salerno, I returned to Cairo, and returned to Cairo, and then I returned to England with malaria and took over the Army Film Unit at Pinewood, where we teamed up with the RAF Film Unit. Then I had to go into hospital with very bad malaria, and then it was after I came out of that I went to Burma.
Called out especially by Mountbatten. You've kindly allowed me to take away the papers which Mountbatten sent you during the production of Burma Victory, so I won't ask you detailed questions about this period. But in general, was it easy to film in the Far East? Were the authorities more cooperative there than they'd been in the Western Desert?
In the Far East, very definitely, because we had the backing very strongly of Lord Mountbatten. So that paths were very definitely smooth the whole way down. Some of the generals, for example, Field Marshal Slim, as he eventually became, was fascinated with film always. He gave one tremendous opportunities for filming the whole way from when I joined the 14th Army, from the whole of Imphal right down to Singapore. We had facilities every inch of the way.
Mountbatten's interest in film wasn't so keen that it led him to interfere and to obstruct your work, really, as a director.
Absolutely not. He was very He was very cooperative in every single way. While I was in Burma, for example, I went with Lord Louis to Chungking when he went to see Chiang Kai-shek. And he provided all the facilities. He even arranged the party around Chiang Kai-shek with himself in the middle for us to photograph. On that particular occasion, I had a camera, but we wanted sound. We had no sound in Burma at all. So the sound was provided by a colonel, Irving Asher, who was on Mountbatten's staff with his cameras. We borrowed his cameras for that, sound cameras. So we got these wonderful shots, which Chiang Kai-shek again helped to organize.
Did you ever press for your unit, I'm talking in general, the Army Film Photographic Unit, to be equipped with sound cameras in the Middle East, in Europe, in Italy?
No, we didn't. We never did have sound. Except in the headquarters back here in Pinewood Studios.
Would it not have been a practical proposition?
Sound equipment was awfully difficult to come by and very cumbersome. It's not the sort of sound equipment in, shall we say, in the forward areas in Burma or shall we say, in the Western Desert. It's much too cumbersome, sound equipment.
And the use of colour film, did you rule this out for what reason?
We never ruled it out. We just couldn't get it.
Did you apply for it?
We applied for it on many occasions. I said everything should be shot in colour, but the colour just wasn't there, colour film.
You mentioned how you shot colour film on the Fulton Raid in 16mm.
That was on 16mm. I couldn't get any 35mm colour.
Arthur Graham, though, did apparently shoot.
He shot because we had... I sent him off on the long-range desert group, and he did shoot in colour.
Of the long-range desert group?
Of the long-range desert group, which, incidentally, has never been shown. I think I told you that before.
Yes, it's never been found.
It's never been found.
Since about 1950.
Yeah, that's right.
But this was 35mm camera.
That's right.
Had you brought that film out yourself from Technicolor?
We got it through, funny enough, the Cairo-owned laboratories.
Cairo-owned? Technicolor's Cairo.
Technicolor. That's right.
Right.
Technicolor, Cairo.
And then it was sent back to London or to Hollywood for
processing. It was sent to London to be processed by, you know, the Technicolor labs opposite the London airport there.
Did you see the colour film yourself?
Yes, I did.
The Long Range Desert Group?
Yeah, Long Range Desert Group. It wasn't terribly good.
From the technical point of view.
Technical point of view. And the real point was it was, you see, practically all their operations were carried out at night. So except for an occasional blast of a bomb or something like that, I mean, there was nothing to see. You could see it, you could see the Long Range Desert Group taking off from their base in something oasis, I've forgotten the name of it.
Siwa
oasis. See them taking off in the late evening, but that's as far as you got, really.
And this had all been filmed in colour.
Yes.
Can you picture it in your mind now?
Mm. Oh, yes. I mean,
Have you spoken to Arthur Graham since the war?
Many times, yes. Mm. Oh, yes. Have you seen him recently?
Yes, I have, but I've asked him about this kind of film, and we're still trying to trace it. Well, to return to 1945, after Burm Victory was finished and shown, you were demobbed?
I was demobbed. I was under contract at that time to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Whilst you were still commander of the army.
I was under contract to take up the appointment as a director for MGM. Directly I was demobilised. I tried to get
MGM in England.
MGM Hollywood. I tried to get demobilisation in America, but they couldn't do it. So I came back to this country and immediately started working with MGM over here. But I was always loaned out. I never made a film in this country for MGM. I was always loaned out to J. Arthur Rank, and I made 6 pictures in a row with J. Arthur Rank.
And that was after you had actually left the unit. And did you, as the commander of the unit, hope that it would survive? Did you try to ensure that it would survive?
I tried very hard to get it to let it survive, but the War Office, that time I think they probably said they couldn't afford an army film in it. Army film was fairly expensive to run, comparatively speaking. If you think of the processing of film, the film itself in those days was very expensive, just after the war. So that we never did. The army film unit was disbanded, which I always think was a great mistake.